Chapter 40. Belliard, while we were in London, Mr. Jarndyce was constantly beset by the crowd of excitable ladies and gentlemen whose proceedings had so much astonished us. Mr. Quayle, who presented himself soon after our arrival, was in all such excitements. He seemed to project those two shining knobs of temples of his into everything that went on, and to brush his hair farther and farther back, until the very roots were almost ready to fly out of his head in an appreciable philanthropy. All objects were alike to him, but he was always particularly ready for anything in the way of a testimonial to anyone. His great power seemed to be his power of indiscriminate admiration. He would sit for any length of time, with the utmost enjoyment, bathing his temples in the light of any order of luminary. Having first seen him perfectly swallowed up in admiration of Mrs. Jellyby, I had supposed her to be the absorbing object of his devotion. I soon discovered my mistake, and found him to be train bearer and organ blower to a whole procession of people. Mrs. Pardiggle came one day for a subscription to something, and with her, Mr. Quayle. Whatever Mrs. Pardiggle said, Mr. Quayle repeated to us, and just as he had drawn Mrs. Jellyby out, he drew Mrs. Pardiggle out. Mrs. Pardiggle wrote a letter of introduction to my guardian in behalf of her eloquent friend Mr. Gusher. With Mr. Gusher appeared Mr. Quayle again. Mr. Gusher, being a flabby gentleman with a moist surface and eyes, so much too small for his moon of a face, that they seemed to have been originally made for somebody else, was not at first sight prepossessing. Yet he was scarcely seated before Mr. Quayle asked Ada and me, not inaudibly, whether he was not a great creature, which he certainly was, flabbily speaking, though Mr. Quayle meant an intellectual beauty, and whether we were not struck by his massive configuration of brow. In short, we heard of a great many missions of various sorts among this set of people, but nothing respecting them was half so clear to us as that it was Mr. Quayle's mission to be in ecstasies with everybody else's mission, and that it was the most popular mission of all. Mr. Jarndyce had fallen into this company in the tenderness of his heart and his earnest desire to do all the good in his power, but that he felt it to be too often an unsatisfactory company, where benevolence took spasmodic forms, where charity was assumed as a regular uniform by loud professors and speculators in cheap notoriety, vehement in profession, restless and vain in action, servile in the last degree of meanness to the great, adulatory of one another, and intolerable to those who were anxious quietly to help the weak from failing, rather than with a great deal of bluster and self-laudation to raise them up a little way when they were down, he plainly told us. When a testimonial was originated to Mr. Quayle by Mr. Gusher, who had already got one, originated by Mr. Quayle, and when Mr. Gusher spoke for an hour and a half on the subject to a meeting, including two charity schools of small boys and girls, who were specially reminded of the widow's mite, and requested to come forward with halfpence and be acceptable sacrifices, I think the wind was in the east for 3 whole weeks. I mention this because I am coming to Mr. Skimpole again. It seemed to me that his offhand professions of childishness and carelessness were a great relief to my guardian, by contrast with such things, and were the more readily believed in, since to find one perfectly undesigning and candid man among many opposites could not fail to give him pleasure. I should be sorry to imply that Mr. Skimpole divined this and was politic. I really never understood him well enough to know. What he was to my guardian, he certainly was to the rest of the world. He had not been very well, and thus, though he lived in London, we had seen nothing of him until now. He appeared one morning in his usual agreeable way, and as full of pleasant spirits as ever. "Well," he said, "here he was." He had been bilious, but rich men were often bilious, and therefore he had been persuading himself that he was a man of property. So he was, in a certain point of view, in his expansive intentions. He had been enriching his medical attendant in the most lavish manner. He had always doubled, and sometimes quadrupled, his fees. He had said to the doctor, "Now, my dear doctor, it is quite a delusion on your part to suppose that you attend me for nothing. I am overwhelming you with money in my expansive intentions, if you only knew it." And really, he said, he meant it to that degree that he thought it much the same as doing it. If he had had those bits of metal, or thin paper to which mankind attached so much importance to put in the doctor's hand, he would have put them in the doctor's hand. Not having them, he substituted the will for the deed. Very well. If he really meant it, if his will were genuine and real, which it was, it appeared to him that it was the same as coin, and cancelled the obligation. It may be, partly, because I know nothing of the value of money, said Mr. Skimpole, but I often feel this. It seems so reasonable. My butcher says to me, he wants that little bill. It's a part of the pleasant unconscious poetry of the man's nature that he always calls it a little bill to make the payment appear easy to both of us. I reply to the butcher, "My good friend, if you knew it, you are paid. You haven't had the trouble of coming to ask for the little bill. You are paid. I mean it." "But, suppose," said my guardian, laughing, "he had meant the meat and the bill instead of providing it?" "My dear Jarndyce," he returned, "you surprise me. You take the butcher's position." A butcher I once dealt with occupied that very ground. Says he, "Sir, why did you eat spring lamb at 18p a pound?" Why did I eat spring lamb at 18p a pound, my honest friend? Said I, naturally amazed by the question. "I like spring lamb." This was so far convincing. "Well, sir," says he, "I wish I had meant the lamb as you mean the money." My good fellow, said I, "pray let us reason like intellectual beings. How could that be? It was impossible. You had got the lamb, and I have not got the money. You couldn't really mean the lamb without sending it in, whereas I can, and do, really mean the money without paying it." He had not a word. There was an end of the subject. "Did he take no legal proceedings?" inquired my guardian. "Yes, he took legal proceedings," said Mr. Skimpole. "But in that he was influenced by passion, not by reason. Passion reminds me of Boythorn. He writes me that you and the ladies have promised him a short visit at his bachelor house in Lincolnshire. He is a great favorite with my girls," said Mr. Jarndyce, "and I have promised for them." "Nature forgot to shade him off, I think," observed Mr. Skimpole to Ada and me. "A little too boisterous like the sea. A little too vehement like a bull who has made up his mind to consider every color scarlet. But I grant a sledge-hammering sort of merit in him. I should have been surprised if those two could have thought very highly of one another, Mr. Boythorn attaching so much importance to many things and Mr. Skimpole caring so little for anything. Besides which, I had noticed Mr. Boythorn more than once on the point of breaking out into some strong opinion when Mr. Skimpole was referred to. Of course, I merely joined Ada in saying that we had been greatly pleased with him." "He has invited me," said Mr. Skimpole, "and if a child may trust himself in such hands, which the present child is encouraged to do, with the united tenderness of two angels, to guard him I shall go. He proposes to frank me down and back again. I suppose it will cost money? Shillings, perhaps? Or pounds? Or something of that sort. By the by, Covenses. You remember our friend Covenses, Miss Summerson? He asked me as the subject arose in his mind, in his graceful, light-hearted manner, and without the least embarrassment." "Oh, yes," said one. "Covenses has been arrested by the great bailiff," said Mr. Skimpole. "He will never do violence to the sunshine anymore." It quite shocked me to hear it, for I had already recalled with anything but a serious association the image of the man sitting on the sofa that night wiping his head. "His successor informed me of it yesterday," said Mr. Skimpole. His successor is in my house now in possession, I think he calls it. He came yesterday, on my blue-eyed daughter's birthday. I put it to him, this is unreasonable and inconvenient. If you had a blue-eyed daughter you wouldn't like me to come, uninvited, on her birthday? Apostrophe apostrophe but he stayed. Mr. Skimpole laughed at the pleasant absurdity, and lightly touched the piano by which he was seated. And he told me, he said, playing little chords where I shall put full stops, the Covenses had left. Three children. No mother. And that Covenses profession. Being unpopular. The rising Covenses were at a considerable disadvantage. Mr. Jarndyce got up, rubbing his head, and began to walk about. Mr. Skimpole played the melody of one of Ada's favorite songs. Ada and I both looked at Mr. Jarndyce, thinking that we knew what was passing in his mind. After walking and stopping, and several times leaving off rubbing his head, and beginning again, my guardian put his hand upon the keys and stopped Mr. Skimpole's playing. I don't like this, Skimpole, he said thoughtfully. Mr. Skimpole, who had quite forgotten the subject, looked up surprised. The man was necessary, pursued my guardian, walking backward and forward in the very short space between the piano and the end of the room, and rubbing his hair up from the back of his head, as if a high east wind had blown it into that form. If we make such men necessary by our faults and follies, or by our want of worldly knowledge, or by our misfortunes, we must not revenge ourselves upon them. There was no harm in his trade. He maintained his children. One would like to know more about this. Oh, Covenses? Cried Mr. Skimpole, at length perceiving what he meant. Nothing easier. A walk to Covenses' headquarters, and you can know what you will. Mr. Jarndyce nodded to us, who were only waiting for the signal. Come. We will walk that way, my dears. Why not that way, as soon as another? We were quickly ready and went out. Mr. Skimpole went with us, and quite enjoyed the expedition. It was so new and so refreshing, he said, for him to want Covenses instead of Covenses wanting him. He took us, first, to Cursitor Street, Chancery Lane, where there was a house with barred windows, which he called Covenses Castle. On our going into the entry and ringing a bell, a very hideous boy came out of a sort of office, and looked at us over a spiked wicket. Who did you want? Said the boy, fitting two of the spikes into his chin. There was a follower, or an officer, or something, here, said Mr. Jarndyce, who is dead. Yes? Said the boy. Well? I want to know his name, if you please. Name of Neckett, said the boy. And his address? Bell Yard, said the boy. Chandler's shop, left-hand side, name of Blinder. Was he I don't know how to shape the question murmured my guardian, industrious? Was naked? Said the boy. Yes, worry much so. He was never tired of watching. He'd set upon a post at a street corner 8 or 10 hours at a stretch, if he undertook to do it. He might have done worse, I heard my guardian soliloquize. He might have undertaken to do it, and not done it. Thank you. That's all I want. We left the boy, with his head on one side, and his arms on the gate, fondling and sucking the spikes, and went back to Lincoln's Inn, where Mr. Skimpole, who had not cared to remain near Covenses, awaited us. Then we all went to Bell Yard, a narrow alley at a very short distance. We soon found the chandler's shop. In it was a good-natured looking old woman with a dropsy, or an asthma, or perhaps both. Neckett's children? Said she in reply to my inquiry. Yes, surely, miss. Three pair, if you please. Door right opposite the stairs. And she handed me the key across the counter. I glanced at the key and glanced at her, but she took it for granted that I knew what to do with it. As it could only be intended for the children's door, I came out without asking any more questions, and led the way up the dark stairs. We went as quietly as we could, But four of us made some noise on the EH boards, and when we came to the second story we found we had disturbed a man who was standing there looking out of his room. "Is it Gridley that's wanted?" he said, fixing his eyes on me with an angry stare. "No, sir," said I. "I am going higher up." He looked at Otta, and at Mr. Jarndyce, and at Mr. Skimpole, fixing the same angry stare on each in succession as they passed and followed me. Mr. Jarndyce gave him good day. "Good day," he said abruptly and fiercely. He was a tall, sallow man with a careworn head on which but little hair remained, a deeply lined face, and prominent eyes. He had a combative look and a chafing, irritable manner which, associated with his figure still large and powerful, though evidently in its decline, rather alarmed me. He had a pen in his hand, and in the glimpse I caught of his room in passing, I saw that it was covered with a litter of papers. Leaving him standing there, we went up to the top room. I tapped at the door, and a little shrill voice inside said, "We are locked inches. Mrs. Blinder's got the key." I applied the key on hearing this, and opened the door. In a poor room with a sloping ceiling and containing very little furniture was a mite of a boy, some 5 or 6 years old, nursing and hushing a heavy child of 18 months. There was no fire, though the weather was cold. Both children were wrapped in some poor shawls and tippets as a substitute. Their clothing was not so warm, however, but that their noses looked red and pinched and their small figures shrunken as the boy walked up and down nursing and hushing the child with its head on his shoulder. "Who has locked you up here alone?" we naturally asked. "Charlie," said the boy, standing still to gaze at us. "Is Charlie your brother?" "No. She's my sister, Charlotte. Father called her Charlie." "Are there any more of you besides Charlie?" "Me," said the boy, "and Emma," patting the limp bonnet of the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.